Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
When you are pioneering anything or introducing new ideas to the culture,
you get criticized.
You do?
Yeah. Did you hear about that?
I didn't find the one. I found someone I respected and we made it the one.
In a sort of longing kind of view of love, people understand each other as if by magic.
Nothing in itself is addictive on the one hand. On the other hand, everything could be addictive if there's an emptiness in that person that needs to be filled.
I now know that nobody changes until they change their energy. And when you change your energy, you change your life.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Here we go. Lisa Mosconi is a leading expert in women's brain health. She is an associate professor of neurology at Cornell, where she's also the director of its Women's Brain Initiative and the Alzheimer's Prevention Program. She is a New York Times bestselling author, and her latest book is called The Menopause Brain. Today, Lisa explains how hormonal shifts during perimenopause and menopause can impact cognitive health, and how many of the symptoms, including hot flashes, brain fog, depression, and anxiety, start in the brain. We talked about how menopause is still overlooked and understudied, and the societal stigma that marks menopause as the end of a woman's life. Instead, Lisa sees menopause as an opportunity, one that imbues a post-reductive woman with the value that she deserves. She shares some of the clinical trials and brain imaging work her lab is doing to better understand this stage of life and her key advice for what women should be aware of when it comes to keeping our brains healthy as we age.
This book is great.
Thank you.
I have so many questions.
Oh, good. For you. I'm glad.
There were so many things illuminated for me when I was reading, and then so many things that I wanted to double click on. I had never really fathomed that hormonal changes impacted the brain. So when I was looking at the brain scans that you've put in the book, anecdotally, you know, you hear a lot about hormones and moods and all this, but I never realized that when you map the brain that you can see that there are biological changes happening in the brain. So does this start in puberty? And where does this, the impact of hormone shifts, start to impact what the brain looks like?
Like you said, they start the puberty. So there's a system that connects the brain to the ovaries that is called the neuroendocrine system. So neuro for brain, endocrine for hormonal system, that we are born with. So all individuals who have two X chromosomes and are born with ovaries are also born with this pathway that connects the brain to the reproductive organs that is silent, if you will, until puberty hits. And then the system is activated in the way that the brain talks to the ovaries and the ovaries talk back to the brain is by shooting up and down hormones. These chemicals that we call sex hormones, which is completely a mislabeling. So they were identified by scientists who were looking at reproductive function. And so as they were found in the 1930s, the scientists referred to them as sex hormones. But it wasn't until 1996 that other scientists discovered that the same exact hormones that are important for having children and just having reproductive fertility are also just as important for the functioning of our minds and our brains. Those are neuroprotective hormones. They're growth hormones. They're energizing hormones. They do so many things inside your brain that we're just really starting to fully understand. But to your point, puberty is when the system is activated. And then what happens, and it's like this connection between the brain and the ovaries is turned on and is consistently evolving every month as the ovaries cycle, the brain microcycles, which is something that we never talk about. And then the system is overactivated during pregnancy, every time a woman gets pregnant, but then it needs to be turned down after menopause. And it's the turning down that triggers a rewiring in the brain that also prompts some of the symptoms of menopause, the vulnerability that we associate with menopause, but also at the same time changes your brain in such a way that enables women to outlive menopause and spend another 20, 30 years in a non-reproductive stage that can be just as productive. And it's really these changes that enable all this. And I think it's so important to talk about them because we don't, as a society, as women, even as academics, we just don't talk about the importance of this network for not just for reproductive function, reproductive health, but also for brain health.
I want to know more about something you just said, which is that the changes enable us to live for another 30 years after menopause, plus or minus, which is super interesting. You know, you talk about in the book that we're really the only mammals that live a long time after menopause, and that throughout nature, what's the most normal is that, you know, an ant, even chimpanzees, right? You say they're most closely related to us. They die a couple years after menopause. So what did you find in your research about why human beings, like what is the evolutionary purpose of us being able to live 30 years after menopause when none of our cousins in the animal kingdom seem to mimic those patterns?
That's right. Let's put it this way. The scientists are debating over this point, and there are two major schools of thought. There's scientists who believe that menopause is a mistake, that medical technology and hygiene and advancements have prolonged and extended women's lives beyond what nature intended. And then there are many more scientists, I would say myself included, who look at the evolutionary significance of menopause and the role that women serve for society and in the lives of the family. And then we land on the grandmother hypothesis, which is lovely and makes also a lot of sense. So the pushback that we're getting in this respect is that the theory of evolution states that the only purpose of life is to pass on your genes to the next generations. Mm-hmm. So menopause in that respect is a pure contradiction of Darwin and whatever his thinking was, right? Menopause goes against directly against this theory of evolution, because when women stop being fertile in midlife and they live past it, then that is very bizarre from an evolutionary perspective. But if you think about it, it makes a lot more sense for women to stop having children at some point in time and to remain available to their daughters and sons and help them raise their kids, basically. So they are prehistoric grandmothers at some point, most likely had an evolutionary advantage by becoming grandmothers, not longer being reproductive, but being able to stay there and raise the grandchildren and make sure that their own daughters could have more children and still be safe and fed and taken care of. And I think this is a much more flattering view of women of all ages. And anyone who's ever had a grandmother could probably attest to the fact that grandmothers are extremely productive and extremely valuable and extremely important for families. And some even say that these grandmothers who were able to survive multiple childbirths and also live past menopause were not just any grandmothers. Those were the fittest women in the tribe. Therefore, most likely they also had some kind of super genes that made them particularly strong and resilient against aging and a number of issues. And therefore, we are now blessed with their genetics that enable us to live very long lives that can be very healthy and fulfilling, just not reproductive for a certain amount of time. And the thing is it makes a lot more sense to me.
It's a very beautiful theory as well.
It's a beautiful theory.
And a theory that imbues an older post-reproductive woman with the value that she deserves. You know, it's like a societal place that she's fought for and won and deserved and gives a lot of respect.
Yes, oh, for sure. I think it's this whole narrative of women only being helpful for as long as we are reproductive is completely outdated. And the sad part is that it's really the backbone of modern medicine. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons that we know so little about women's health. Just for context, the fact that estrogen is not just a sex hormone, but also a brain hormone, was discovered in 1996. Mm-hmm. Men landed on the moon 30 years prior. You know, like, we know more about space than about women's brains. I find this so bizarre, and I think it's time for scientists to start looking into women's health in a more integrated way, not just breasts and ovaries, but we need to look at women as organisms, not just some parts and bits and pieces that magically come together and make a person.
Do you think we're starting to have a more female-centric understanding in medicine? Is there a shift towards wanting to understand and provide care?
I would say yes. There was this really important study that was published almost 15 years ago now, showing that heart disease manifests differently in women than in men, right? And now everybody is aware of that. I mean, I don't know if everybody, but many people are aware of that. Mm-hmm. And that was really shocking. I feel like it was quite groundbreaking for not just for cardiology, but in general for scientists to be able to push back a little bit more. For me, my background is in neuroscience. I'm a neuroscientist, and I study Alzheimer's disease, especially prevention of Alzheimer's disease.
It's because your mother had Alzheimer's, right?
My grandmother.
Your grandmother.
Yes. So my grandmother was one of four siblings, three sisters and one brother. And all three sisters developed Alzheimer's disease and died of it, whereas the brother did not. And that was very scary for us. And I'm from Italy, like we were talking about before, and there's no senior homes in Italy. There's no assisted living. So my grandmother was living with us. And that was shocking in so many ways and heartbreaking in so many ways. But also as a PhD student, my question immediately was like, is it just me? Is it just my family? Or are women overall at higher risk for dementia? Now we know better. We know that almost two-thirds of all Alzheimer's patients are women, and there's a strong interest to understand why. Whereas for a long time, people would just say, oh, it's just longevity. Like for me, it was consistent. Everybody would say to me, oh, you know, sweetheart, it's just that women live longer than men, and Alzheimer's disease is a disease of old age. Therefore, more women than men end up with dementia. And I was like, but we don't live that much longer than men. And so my PhD thesis actually was about showing that Alzheimer's is not a disease of old age, but is a disease of midlife with symptoms that start in old age.
Wow.
And that changed the whole question, because then the question was, okay, if Alzheimer's starts in midlife, then what happens to women and not to men in midlife? They could potentially explain the higher risk of dementia later in life. And we tried all these different things. We did so many different studies. And then we realized that menopause was really what was tipping the scales.
Wow.
And that's how I started to study menopause. But it was really going against what we were told there's just longevity, there's nothing about women, it's not important. And as soon as we started talking about hormones, everybody thought I lost my mind.
Of course. So what conclusions or what lines were you able to draw between loss of estrogen and the propensity to develop Alzheimer's?
I would say that estrogen is a very brain protective hormone, and so is progesterone. So as women go through menopause, the brain needs to adjust to the loss of a very strong protective element. Therefore, for a certain number of years, the brain becomes more vulnerable in some ways. And that is potentially why we see that women have an increased risk of depressive symptoms during menopause or of anxiety, or women who have a predisposition to Alzheimer's disease, like women with a family history or the APOE4 genotype. We tend to see the signs of Alzheimer's disease in their brains during the transition of menopause. So in a way, menopause doesn't make you sick. It doesn't cause any diseases, but you as a woman may be more vulnerable to developing certain medical risks or conditions as you transition to menopause. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like an activator. It's not something that makes you sick, and it's certainly not a disease or a medical condition. But there is
an increase. It feels like it sometimes.
I heard that. I hear that often. But there's a difference between a disease and a risk factor. So I would say that menopause is a risk factor for certain medical disorders or certain medical conditions, but it's certainly not illness.
What are some common misconceptions about menopause and aging that you aren't aligned with?
Oh, there are quite a few. I would say the most immediate one is that most people think that menopause happens when you're old. And I think it's important to realize that that is not the case. That the average age of onset in the United States is 51, 52, but globally is 49.
Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
And perimenopause, so significant shifting in hormones can start as early as when, 36, 38?
Even earlier than that. For some women, it's even earlier. Yeah, so the average age at perimenopause is 47, but the range is between 32 and 55. I think just a couple of women can make it to 55, yes. So it can span easily a decade. The average duration is 7 years, is between 4 and 7 years, depending on ethnicity, but it can last a decade. And a lot of women are just not aware that that's something that can happen to them in their 30s or 40s. I have a friend of mine who's 38, and she was having a really hard time. And she went to so many doctors, and the doctors just could not place it, could not understand what was happening. And it just...
That's insane. It's like the most simple blood test to do.
Or even just ask. I asked her, is your period consistent? Are you skipping periods? And she's like, yeah, I just missed my period a couple of times. I was a little worried. I said, well, you know, it could be perimenopause. And she's like, I'm 38. I said, yeah, it could be like, exactly. You're 38. You need to go see a doctor. You need to have it tested. And so she went, and sure enough, she's in perimenopause, and
wow,
it's very early. But we know that the age of onset, so women who are like African-American women, Hispanic women, tend to start the process even earlier.
And do you attribute that to what? I mean, Is it?
It's a combination.
Is it tied to a socioeconomic thing as well, like environmental toxins or?
Potentially, surely there's some genetic background, and then there's stress, perhaps stress, and yeah, there's a trauma seems to be associated with that too. The thing about menopause is that it is shockingly understudied. This is something I do not understand. Every woman who lives long enough, but just pretty much all women go through menopause in the course of their lives, and we know so little about this process. We know more about puberty by a long shot. We know more about pregnancy, even though not all women get pregnant. Right? And we should know about pregnancy. We should really know a lot about pregnancy. But then menopause arrives and nobody knows what it is. We don't talk about it in the family. My mom never talked to me about menopause until I asked her, because I wanted to know, okay, what am I, you know, what's it going to be like? Because it's linked in part, it's genetically linked. So your mother is actually your best predictor of what your menopause is going to be like, at least in terms of when, what age, what kind of symptoms. But most
my mother can't remember. I'm like, Mom, what's the deal? Like, what am I up against here? And she's like, I can't remember what happened.
Oh, that's a good sign. Maybe it wasn't that bad. And then she just does it. She's
like, it was bad. Believe me. Oh, it was bad. I think she just doesn't remember when it happened. When it was all over with. So if someone, like to this end, if somebody is experiencing symptoms earlier as opposed to later, how is that in and of itself affecting cognitive function and overall brain health?
I think it depends on why you are experiencing menopause earlier. There are women who unfortunately go through menopause for medical procedures like oophorectomies and hysterectomies. And the age of onset tends to be, you know, much earlier in life. And that also correlates with more severe symptoms of menopause, because the change in hormonal concentration is more sudden, is more abrupt. You basically go through menopause almost overnight. Then there's other procedures, like for patients who have breast cancer, right? Mm-hmm. There's chemotherapy and endocrine therapy that can trigger menopause either temporarily or permanently as well. And the symptoms tend to be more acute and potentially more severe. So this is also something, you know, this is something that is so upsetting to me, that the medical framework for menopause completely ignores the range of symptoms. To think about it, for pregnancy, we finally acknowledge and formalize the fact that different women have different experiences, where some women just breathe through pregnancy and postpartum, which is wonderful, but many women have the baby blues. Some women experience postpartum depression, and some women have postpartum psychosis. So there is an understanding that the experience can really range in severity, in intensity, in duration. And that is extremely important, because now you go to the pediatrician and they screen you for depression as a mother. And there are medications that are being developed specifically for postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis. There's no such thing for menopause. For as long as you have a menstrual period, even if it's just once every 11 months, the answer is pretty much just, oh, you have your period still, so just kind of grin and bear it. Yeah. And once you have the symptoms, it's like a one-size-fits-all experience. Do you have hot flashes? Well, let's talk about how many, how long, how severe, what kind, how do you respond to them? Do you feel dizzy? Do you have palpitations? Let's check that your vascular system is intact. There's none of that. There's no acknowledgement that there are some women, 10%, who breeze through menopause again, who are perfectly fine, have no brain symptoms, at least, on menopause. And there are women who are suicidal.
Yeah.
And there's no acknowledgement of that. Mm-hmm. And that really, in a way, invalidates women's experience and makes you less able to advocate for yourself when you go to your doctor. And it also limits your physician's ability to help you.
Yeah. What are the things that we should ask for when we go to the doctor, whether we're 38 and experiencing, you know, some think we don't even know it's hormonal changes, like up through full on symptomatic perimenopause? Like, what are the things when we go in, what do we need to be asking our doctors?
We need to be asking for a thorough medical evaluation that also includes information from our family history. In my opinion, it's very helpful to know if your mother went through menopause early, late, somewhere in between. Maybe you have a sister, an older sister, your aunts, because it does run in families in some to some extent. And then it's important to discuss things that one may have done to impact their own menopause, like smoking. We don't talk about it that much, but tobacco smoke is the number one ovarian toxin. And if you've smoked at least 100 cigarettes in your entire life, they may lower your age of menopause.
Oh, boy. So only 100 cigarettes? God.
Yes.
I burned through that number in by 1997, I think.
Oh, so that may lower your age of menopause. And I think in that case, it's really important to focus on antioxidants to help balance out whatever damage the cigarettes may have done. I take vitamin C supplements daily for the same reason, because I grew up in Italy, everybody was smoking, and so I did too. And 100 cigarettes, not that many at the end of the day.
Yeah, seriously. I feel like I had certain bad weeks where I smoked 100 cigarettes.
In a week. But then other things that we need to ask is for a complete medical checkup. And
so what does that involve? Like, tell us exactly. Mm-hmm. So you said, you mentioned something about our vascular systems.
Yes.
How do we check that? What do we ask for?
Yes.
What do we ask for in terms of blood work? Like, give us the list.
So it depends on which specialist we're going to, right? So right now, menopause is OB-GYN territory. And that is wonderful because the ovaries are really important. However, there's more to menopause than just the menstrual cycle. So what we do, I run the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City, where we have an Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic as part of the program. And we work very closely with our colleagues in OB-GYN, but also in cardiology, in preventative cardiology. And we work with endocrinology, and we work with metabolic health, so that our patients really receive integrative care that covers many different aspects of menopause. So for my part, a lot of our patients come to us for brain fog.
Yeah.
So over 60% of women going through perimenopause and menopause, postmenopause.
But they're coming to be evaluated in the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic?
Yes, they're terrified.
Right.
They're so scared that they might be developing dementia, early onset dementia. That comes up a lot. Like, I can't think straight. My brain is not functioning. I can't turn my brain on. My brain just is not responding to me. And I'm so scared. This happens a lot to our patients who come to us because they can't remember things. They're fumbling with words. They lose their train of thoughts. They walk in a room and can't remember why they're there.
This happens to me all the time, by the way.
Is this scary, or are you more like whatever?
You know, I think at first I was scared by it because I used to have a very strong facility with language and word recall. And I considered myself to be relatively articulate. But now what will happen is I will literally not, I'll know sort of the abstraction, the shape of the word in my head, but I can't translate it into something that will come out of my mouth. So at first I was really scared when it started happening. It was also dovetailing with long COVID. So I had brain fog anyway, but this was really cognitively, I was like, oh my God. But then I started to there was some pattern recognition that right before my cycle, it got really bad. And then afterwards, the words would sort of slowly start to come back. But really through my menstrual cycle, I had really low cognitive function. I mean, for me. And so now I'm not as scared by it. But I'm like, you know, and I've had a brain scan just to make sure.
Well, I strongly recommend it. This is what we do with our patients. When they come to us for brain fog, obviously we need to do a lot of exclusion analysis to make sure that this is not like a vitamin deficiency, or it's not thyroid disease, or you don't have a brain tumor. So we do a lot of tests, including cognitive testing and brain imaging. because my background is in nuclear medicine. I do brain scans for a living. And I think it's so helpful and so important to check that your brain is okay, because otherwise, how would you know? So when we do cognitive testing, what we've learned about brain fog in particular is that if you start up here, right, there's a high chance that most women experience a dip during perimenopause. And then there's either a stabilization or a rebound, or some women keep declining. And it's really important to understand the trajectory of changes over time, because for those who rebound, great, that's a sign.
Yeah, but what are the factors that are making, have you identified the factors that help them rebound?
We are studying this. The whole field is trying to understand that better. There are a few things for sure. Overall medical health is a big factor. How you go through menopause is another big factor. Women who go through menopause spontaneously as part of the aging process tend to have a more gentle transition as compared to women who are.
What is spontaneously? Like it just stops one day?
Yeah, spontaneously is for most women when there's no surgeries involved, there's no medical procedures, there's no POI. So most women go through menopause. The clinicians say natural menopause. I find that it's not a very thoughtful word in some instances, because you are suggesting that a woman who goes through menopause because of a medical procedure is doing something unnatural, unnatural. So I prefer spontaneous. So I say spontaneous. Other people do too. But so most women go through menopause just as part of the aging process. And usually the transition is more gentle. But then for some women, the cognitive decline is persistent and it doesn't resolve a few years after menopause. That's when we start talking about Alzheimer's prevention, and we're a little bit more aggressive, if you will, in terms of what to do and what not to do. But overall, medical health is a big factor. History of smoking and toxin exposure is another factor. Certainly your exercise levels, overall inflammation in your body is another factor. Mm-hmm. And for some women, hormone therapy is helpful, or other interventions that reduce and alleviate the symptoms of menopause. Because the more symptoms you have, the more hot flashes you have, the more night sweats you have, the less sleep you get, the more stress you have, that all impacts your cognitive performance in the end. And it's kind of hard to disentangle what's driving what.
Yeah.
So we're just mostly trying to go after solutions. And I'm just excited that today we have a new study that was published just this morning that is the largest meta-analysis, the largest integration of all data available that looks at hormone therapy and the impact on cognitive function in women going through menopause. Because every time we try saying that hormone therapy might be helpful for brain fog, then the pushback immediately is that where are the clinical trials? Mm-hmm. And so we put them all together. There are clinical trials. So we put them all together, and the analysis shows that hormone therapy may help support cognition, at least for some women. So it's something that is worth looking into. And so it's diet and exercise. But you need to, you know, one step at a time.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Acer bag collection in its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Acer is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and the 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Acer collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
Can we spend a little bit of time on hormone replacement therapy? Because this is something that I've read a lot about.
Mm.
And I still am a little bit confused.
Me too.
So I know that in 2002, there was a study that was being done on hormone replacement therapy and for women. And the results of the study were that you were slightly more prone to have a stroke and heart disease, dementia, and breast cancer. So they stopped the study because it was like, okay, these results are not good, and they're putting the cohorts at risk. So since then, women have really struggled with going through menopause without hormone replacement because obviously they're, you know, it had a very bad connotation. And then when, you know, I've listened to a bunch of podcasts as I'm assessing, like, do I do this? Do I not do this? And your book was also incredibly edifying. So it turns out that those women were mostly largely postmenopausal, and they were given conjugated equine therapy, right? So not bioidentical hormones. It was the wrong age. And there were a number of deep flaws with the study. However, even when you look at data around hormone therapy, it's much safer, right, if it's transdermal or vaginal. So a pill form is considered slightly more of a risk factor for these things. But in some cases, it looks like, oh, wow, estrogen replacement really helps prevent dementia and Alzheimer's. But then in some cases, it's like, no, there's more of a risk. Like, what is the deal? Is it safe? Do we do it? Do we avoid it? What happened? You know, I know that if we do it, you're supposed to just do it for 5 years, right? You're not supposed to do it in perpetuity. Like, help me.
They changed that. They changed that.
Do they?
Yes, they changed the rule in 2022.
Yes. I'm like, I take oral progesterone, and I think I want to take some. In fact, I have for my gynecologist some compounded transdermal estradiol. But I'm scared. Like, am I going to be okay? A lot of the, you know, I'm not scared. I shouldn't say that, but there's a lot of competing opinions about this. And so I would just love your point of view.
Yes. HRT has a really tormented history where at first every woman was put on hormones. Very high doses of hormones and left on hormones for life. That was before the Women's Health Initiative.
Okay.
So in the 50s and 60s, when estrogen was the best-selling drug in America. And then the government intervened and said, well, let's do a thorough clinical trial, the Women's Health Initiative, and see if all the things that we're hoping estrogen can do for you are actually happening or not. And like you mentioned, the study was a disaster because in part, it was very ambitious, but the real problem was that clinical trials cannot last forever.
Right.
Right. So if you want to test hormones for prevention of cardiovascular disease or dementia, the only thing that you can do in an 8-year window of time is that you start when women are a little bit older. But for dementia, the age of onset is usually 70 to 72 in the United States. If you have 8 years, you have to start in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And the same for cardiovascular disease and stroke. So what we learned from the Women's Health Initiative is that starting hormones more than 10 years after the final menstrual period is not really as helpful as people were hoping.
Not as helpful, but potentially dangerous?
Potentially dangerous, yes. Yes, at least in that clinical trial, there was a higher risk of stroke and cardiovascular disease and a small increased risk of breast cancer, which is what unfortunately drove the headlines.
Right.
And really led so many women, millions of women, to just go cold turkey and stop taking hormones overnight. What we know now is that the risks were broadly exaggerated. And that hormone therapy, and this is what professional societies say as of 2022, when the revised guidelines were published, hormone therapy is generally safe and well tolerated for most women younger than 60 or within 10 years of the final menstrual period and can be safely taken whether estrogen alone or estrogen and progesterone. Now, healthy women means women who do not have a personal history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer. And then we really need to evaluate individuals with a family history or personal history of cardiovascular disease and blood clots and other things that were a risk in the women's health.
I thought you can't take estrogen without progesterone as well. Can you?
It depends. So if you have a uterus, you need to take a progesterone together with the estrogen, because estrogen is a growth hormone as well. So it kind of increases the risk of endometrial cancer if you don't have a progesterone to bring the risk down. For women who do not have a uterus, then estrogen is usually taken alone. What we know now is that for most women who fit in this category, hormone therapy is generally safe and is approved for a number of indications. Number one, for relief of vasomotor symptoms, which are hot flashes and night sweats. These are neurological symptoms that come from the brain. It's not skin conductance.
What is the functional purpose of hot flashes? Why does our brain do this to us? What is it? What is it? So the brain is causing them, but to what end? Is it to push excess hormones out of the skin? Like, why?
So it's, again, the important part is to think about this as a continuum. So when you hit puberty, your brain needs to be able to increase your body temperature during ovulation, because if you get pregnant, then you need to increase a little bit your body temperature to host the pregnancy. So this gland that we have inside the brain, that's called the hypothalamus, is in charge of doing this exactly. So as your hormones come in from the ovaries, the hypothalamus responds and sends down different hormones that trigger ovulation together with the pituitary gland. So there's a whole network. Then you get pregnant. When a woman gets pregnant, then the hypothalamus is involved in the process to increase body temperature and keep it higher just a little bit, so that the baby can grow healthily and safely. During menopause, what happens is that hormonal concentrations start to fluctuate very, very widely before they bottom out. And so the hormones keep hitting this structure at some point really high, and then they're gone, really high, and then they're gone. It's like hit or miss, hit or miss. And the hypothalamus basically misfires.
Okay.
Yes. Now, the reason that this is happening is that the ovaries are telling the brain, I'm running out of follicles. Very, very soon, I am done. We're never going to talk again. Yeah. But the brain is like, no. Wait a minute. I like having estrogen. I'm going to send down more hormones to make you ovulate, even though you can't at this point. And the whole system is out of balance. And the hypothalamus is the first line of defense, or the first line of contact between the ovaries and the brain. And so it really gets the brunt of the situation. And there's increased inflammation as well. Mm-hmm. We believe that these immune chemicals, they're called microglia, tend to aggregate in the brain during menopause as part of an inflammatory response. And they shoot out cytokines. Mm-hmm. They also contribute to the randomness of the hot flashes and other symptoms of menopause. This has been researched this time. So it's not like there's a good reason to have the hot flashes, other than the system has been dismantled. And that makes sense, because the same brain region that was controlling body temperature throughout ovulation and pregnancy and whatnot, that now needs to be shut down, basically, up to a certain point. So it's a glitch. It's effectively a glitch.
It's a glitch. It feels like a glitch. So.
I'm sure it does. But so hormone therapy can help for hot flashes, and also for
and sleep and mood and my worst symptoms, really, it's anxiety. That's which I've never felt really in my life before. Of course, I've been worried or had periods of stress, but the anxiety where my body is completely hijacked by this other thing has been really startling, I have to say.
Yeah, that is the amygdala. So there's a part of the brain that is connected with the hypothalamus that is called the amygdala. That is the emotional center of the brain and is very rich in estrogen receptors, like the hypothalamus and other parts of the brain that are impacted by menopause. Mm-hmm. And it's the same principle. It's the misfiring and the fluctuating in hormonal concentrations that impact the functioning on this brain region that together with other parts of the brain can induce symptoms of depression and anxiety, rage, irritability, tearfulness, mood changes for many women. Anxiety is tough.
Yeah. So before we just move off this risk, I just am confused about, so the study that was conducted by the WHI, in that study, and forgive me if I'm getting it wrong, but in the placebo group and the HRT group, in the right age, right, you know, healthy perimenopausal women, there was still a slight increase in risk in breast cancer. Is that right?
There were no perimenopausal women in the Women's Health Initiative. All the women were postmenopausal.
It was all postmenopausal.
All postmenopausal women. Some women were slightly younger than the others. If you look at all the women together, it depends on the arm. So there were two different arms in the trial. There was a group of women with the uterus who were given conjugated equine estrogen.
This is the 2002 one.
This is the 2002. So they were taking estrogen with a synthetic progestin. And then there was a group of women without the uterus who were only given estrogen. Okay. In the women with the uterus who were taking this specific type of estrogen and progesterone called MPA, a synthetic type of estrogen, the risk of breast cancer was slightly increased.
Okay.
Whereas in the group of women with no uterus who were taking only estrogen, the risk of breast cancer was slightly decreased.
Okay. Okay. So if you are and the definition of perimenopausal is you're still, no matter how irregular, you're still menstruating and you begin menopause 1 full year after you have not had a period. So at what point is hormone replacement therapy suggested? When symptoms are bad in perimenopause?
That's what it should be. That's okay. Not necessarily when symptoms are bad, when you have symptoms.
Okay.
So hormone therapy was developed for the menopause transition. It was actually thought of as a supplement more than a medication, thinking when your hormones start fluctuating, you want to bring more hormones in so that the concentration eventually would even out and remain stable. In medicine, historically, hormone therapy has been given to women who are past perimenopause and are already in the postmenopausal phase. But in theory, at least, it would be helpful to start prior to the final menstrual period, as long as a woman has symptoms that you want to address. So the hot flashes and night sweats, but also for prevention of osteoporosis and for relief of genital urinary symptoms, which are very disruptive for so many women, it could be fairly easily addressed. Also for sleep disturbances during perimenopause and postmenopause, especially when the sleep disturbances are linked with hot flashes at night, and also for mild depressive symptoms during perimenopause and also the early postmenopausal phase. So there's a number of things that hormones can do for you. They're not magic. You know, it's not like a silver bullet that can fix everything. But the problem is that so many women are just not given the choice to try out the hormones. So right now in the United States, only 4% of all perimenopausal and menopausal women are prescribed hormone therapy for menopause. Maybe more if you look at compounded hormones, but still it's just a small fraction.
Right.
And it's really a missed opportunity because the symptoms are very, very disruptive. And a lot of women don't want to take hormones, which is perfectly fine by me. I just want to make sure that the choice is made based on information and not on fear coming from this study that was published 20 years ago.
Right.
And we have so many more studies done afterwards that really show that hormone therapy is quite safe for many women.
What are some of those studies that we can read?
So the ELITE study is a really good one. E-L-I-T-E. There's all the follow-up studies to the Women's Health Initiative. The one is called WISCA. Another one is the Women's Health Initiative of Younger Women. Perhaps that's a more interesting one because it's in the younger cohort that was included in the Women's Health Initiative. The best way for me personally to look at all the information at once is to look at meta-analysis, which are studies that integrate all the data from all the different clinical trials, all the observational studies, and just give you one number, right? It's that accounting for the variability in different populations and different study settings, we can integrate all this data and hormone therapy can reduce hot flashes by 70% across the board. For me, that is very helpful because it's all studies at once.
And what about the brain with HRT?
What about the brain? We're looking into that now. So it's really interesting that in my field, in neurology and psychiatry, HRT has been understudied, like dramatically so. And we just published a meta-analysis of hormone therapy for dementia prevention just recently that is the largest study integrating everything that's been done looking at HRT for prevention of Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And it's really interesting that the research is not perfect, but if you break down the data and focus on women who are in midlife, not old age, but in midlife, which is when you should be taking hormones, there is a protective effect of estrogen therapy on Alzheimer's. And there's a more variable but still protective effect of estrogen and progesterone on Alzheimer's risk. And similar effects are found for cognitive performance also in midlife. Mm-hmm. And we know that it's also helpful for mood, at least for some women. So this is something to, I think it's something to consider. And again, I'm not pushing HRT. You know, I'm very well aware that some women love it, some women don't love it. It's just really about having all the information one needs to make the best choice for yourself.
Absolutely. And yeah, and to be able to make a choice with all the information without fear or judgment and, you know, yes.
Because the truth is that so many women will go to their doctors and say, you know, I think I'm going through menopause, I'm having a hard time, what can I do? And they just say, well, you know, it's going to be fine. It's just part of aging. And the fact that it's part of aging does not mean that we're fine going through it. And I think it's important to understand that there's a legitimate change inside your brain that can be disconcerting and can impact your quality of life and a lot more than that for a long time. So I think it's important to ask, what are my options? If hormones are an option, great. If you don't want hormones, what are the other options? There are quite a few that most women are not aware of.
Yeah. I guess, are there certain universal truths for brain health that, you know, like nutritionally, what does the brain need to stay healthy as we age? And how much does a focus on nutrition impact our cognitive function?
I would say that nutrition has an impact on cognitive function and also on menopause and the way that women go through menopause and experience menopause. They really kind of go hand in hand.
Tell us more.
Yes. So food is not just something we eat for pleasure or for sustenance or for energy. Food is also information. So the chemicals that are present in our foods, which we call nutrients, are chemical messengers that go straight up into the brain and become part of our brains while also speaking directly to our DNA and informing our DNA of the body's nutritional needs. So we have three options and three chances every day, at least three chances, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, to make a smart choice that is supportive of brain health or not make a smart choice and make a poor choice that may have a negative impact on brain health and cognition and mood and sleep and all the different functionalities that the brain is in charge of. So for, especially for women, the evidence so far, at least, is that a balanced diet that is quite rich in antioxidants, in fiber, in anti-inflammatory compounds, as well as lean protein is really supportive of brain health. Everybody's on different diets, so I think that focusing on the nutrients is perhaps more helpful, right? So as long as you have the nutrients, I don't need to know which kind of diet one is on. Right. Yeah, just make sure that the nutrients are in there. And antioxidants are really super important for brain health because the brain is the most metabolically active organ in the entire body, and it runs on glucose, a simple sugar, to make energy. And this fact means that the brain is also exceptionally vulnerable to oxidative stress and inflammation. And the only way to bring it down is to incorporate antioxidant nutrients from the diet. And these are vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, beta carotene, selenium, all the good antioxidants that are mostly found in fruits and veggies. So a plant forward diet, or at least a diet that includes a decent amount of fresh fruit and vegetables, is supportive of brain health. I don't think anyone has ever had a doubt or any criticisms to that.
And what about fish oils? I always hear fish oil is good for brain health. Is that true?
Omega-3 fatty acids are good for brain health, and fish and fish oil is high in omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids. I think if you eat fish, then you don't need necessarily the fish oil, but it depends on what kind of fish you eat, how often you eat it. So sometimes supplements can be helpful. So the RDA for omega-3s for women are exceptionally low, right? The recommended dietary allowance is like 1.2 grams a day. But imaging studies, brain studies, have shown that the optimal amount, at least in research, is closer to 3 grams or more a day. So it's helpful to maybe check the amount of omega-3s in every person's diet and make sure that at the minimum you meet the 1.2 grams per day. And then if you want to optimize, maybe you shoot for a little higher target, like more like 3 grams a day, which is really not that much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Like a piece of fish. Yeah.
So I guess my last question would be for you, what are you excited about answering next? Like, what are there unanswered questions about the brain, either within the framework of how you're looking at it through menopause or Alzheimer's? Like, what are you excited to figure out?
There are so many things that I would like to do. There are so many things that have not been done. And as a woman and as a scientist, I just find it unacceptable that the answers are just not there, that the data is not there. So we're doing clinical trials now. We're testing some very specific hormones. They're called selective estrogen receptor modulators, or SERMs, that are the one type that we're studying right now is really interesting because it was developed to go straight up inside your brain and leave your reproductive organs alone. Wow. So it's an estrogen for the brain. It's called a neuroSERM. That has no effect, has either a neutral effect or inhibitory effect on reproductive tissue, which means it doesn't increase the risk of cancer to the uterus. So you don't need to take the progesterone, which is really good. And we're doing clinical trials in perimenopausal women, which they really have never been done, for support of cognitive function and for Alzheimer's prevention, starting at the perimenopausal stage, also postmenopausal. So I'm really excited about that. And we're open to enrollment. If anybody
Great. Needs- Sign me up.
Yes. Yeah. So that is very interesting. And the other thing I want to do is, you know, we're always talking about estrogen and estrogen therapy, but the major problem, in my opinion, is that we can't see what the therapy is doing in the brain because there are no brain imaging tools that allow us to measure estrogen activity in the brain. So we're not working to fix that and be able to do the kind of studies which have never been done.
Wow.
I know, it's pathetic, but it's true.
Lisa, thank you so much. This has been so wonderful. And I've learned so much. And the book is fantastic. Thank you for your work and your dedication to this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your time and thank you for having me.
Of course.
This is so great because so many women would be able to hear that the menopause brain is real.
The menopause brain is real. We'll right. show you on a brain scan.
Yes. Come get a brain scan.
I will.
Thank you for tuning in to today's conversation with Lisa Mosconi. For more from Lisa, pick up a copy of her book, The Menopause Brain. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. I hope you'll listen, follow, rate, and review all of our episodes, which are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts.